Produced by Atavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.
Welcome. My name is Julian Schlossberg, and the name of our show is Movie Talk. My guest today is an Emmy Award-winning actress who has starred in motion pictures, Broadway, television. She's also been nominated for Golden Globes and a Tony. Her name is Juliette Mills. Welcome, welcome, Juliette, to the show.
Oh, thank you very much, Julian. Thank you.
You know, it's amazing to we who have no royalty to know that you grew up with royalty, not only as far as the kings and queens, but your dad, Sir John Mills, a wonderful Academy Award-winning actor, your mom, a playwright, a novelist, an actress. It is a hell of a family to begin with, but it could be a double-edged sword. Was it at all?
No, it wasn't, actually, Julian. I always felt so fortunate to have been born into the family, that family, Sir John and Lady M. We had the most wonderful childhood and halcyon days, very happy. We lived in lovely places in England. My father bought a farm when we were children. We all lived on a farm in Sussex. And although, you know, we knew he was a national treasure and they were always surrounded with fascinating, luminous, talented people, we always appreciated. He made us appreciate and always be grateful for what we had, and the fact that he was able to earn a living doing something he loved. And it was just a very wonderful childhood, and I'm so grateful. And I never felt sort of infringed upon or intruded upon or anything. It was good.
Some of my friends who were actors with famous families, their only complaint was that often the parents would go away on location and they weren't with them for times, and that was a difficult thing. Did that happen at all?
Well, not really, because, you see, they sent us to boarding school, so they could go on location.
Right.
And we enjoyed that. Hayley and I both went to Elmhurst Ballet School, which was an offshoot of Sadler's Wells, and did a lot of ballet and all that and acting. And we loved that school. And I think one of the reasons they sent us packing was so that they could go off on locations together. But when we weren't at school, they took us on locations. So we went to some wonderful places, as one does as a film actor. You get to go to wonderful places maybe you would never have gone before, of your own accord.
I think you get rid of the word maybe. You probably never would have gone before. Anyway, I'm interested in knowing, was ballet your first love, not acting?
Yes, it was, yes. I wanted to be a ballet dancer. I went as a day girl to Sadler's Wells when I was about 8 and 9. And then I went to Elmhurst. And it was because I wanted to be a ballet dancer. And, you know, I'd taken lessons since I was little and all that. But then when I was at Elmhurst, I realized that I didn't have that kind of vocational passion that you have to be a prima ballerina. I knew I'd always be in the corps de ballet.
Yes,
and I thought, I don't know, this is an awful lot of hard work. And I think maybe I'd like to be an actress. So that was my second love. But that came along pretty fast.
Well, yes. We can't count in which we serve, because you really weren't totally compassment this, I don't think.
Really?
But let's talk in terms of Alice Through the Looking Glass. You're 14 years old. How does that happen? How did that occur?
Well, actually, they came, the producers of that Alice Through the Looking Glass, which was a Christmas show. Like in England, they do pantomimes and things. They do seasonal shows. So it was going to be a sort of 8-week run in London of Alice Through the Looking Glass. And they came, the producers came to Elmhurst. And I don't remember if I did a, I don't know how I really got it, but they asked if I could be let go, you know, extra time over the Christmas holiday so I could do the show. I think I must have done some sort of audition or sang or something. I don't know. But I looked like Alice at the time. You know, I was only 14. I had hair, long, fair, straight, fair hair. And I was at a dancing school. And I could sing a little. So I suppose, you know, with the name probably helped, actually, you know.
Well, yeah, that was one of the good parts of the sword.
Yes, it was.
Now, we both have mutual friends. And in that show, Dulcie Gray and Michael Dennison, who I have to tell you, I've spent some of the most wonderful evenings of my life with, were in that show. Did they take a shine to you?
Oh, yes. I adored them both. They were so sweet. And of course, they were already friends of my mother and father. So I knew them before I even did Alice. And we had a wonderful time in that we played it, that show at the Chelsea Palace. And it was a wonderful experience for me. Very hard work. You do two shows a day in that sort of setup, you know, pantomime. It wasn't a pantomime because it was Alice and it was a musical and wonderful cast. Binny Barnes was in it. And,
oh, my.
Yeah. It was Dulcie played the White Queen. I can see her now. And Michael, of course, was Humpty Dumpty. I mean, perfect.
Did you ever go to Buckinghamshire to their home?
Yes, I did. I did.
I did,
yes.
Too. And what I loved was to sign the book. They had a book that you would sign when you were dressed. So.
And they came, to Denham, to my parents' house often, which was also in Buckinghamshire. And so I've seen them all through my life, really. You know, I knew them very well. Of course, I think it was one of the reasons my father and mother allowed me to do that show, because they were in it, and then you know, they knew that Michael and Dulcie would keep an eye on me, you know.
Yes. Well, it sounds like you're now going to go perhaps to RADA, Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts, and you try out, but something strange or good seems to happen. But I'm lobbing it into you, Julie.
Gosh, you've done your research.
Oh, I sure have.
Wow. Yes, well, I was going to RADA. I was very excited. I was leaving Elmhurst Ballet School. I was 16. I was going to RADA. And then I was asked to do an audition for a new play by a new playwright called Peter Schaffer. And it was a play called Five Finger Exercise. And it was really Daddy's agent, I think, Laurie Evans, who said, you know, they're looking for a girl 15, 16 years old to play this part in this. I think she should go and do an audition to get experience in auditions, you know, just because I'd never done an audition. And anyway, I went and did it, and I got the part. So I never went to RADA because that play, Five Finger Exercise, Peter Schaffer's first play, was a huge success in London. It ran for over a year. There were only five of us in it. And then it went to New York and was there for 8 months or something, and a huge hit. This new playwright was lauded, and Sir John Gielgud directed it. Jessica Tandy played the mother in New York, and Roland Culver and Brian Bedford, who when we played brother and sister, became my brother in real life. I mean, he's my best friend, and we stayed friends forever until he passed away 4 years ago or something. Yes.
We should point out that Peter Shaffer went on to write Amadeus and The Royal Hunt of the Sun.
And Equus.
So he really was starting out pretty good with five-finger exercise.
Yeah,
now, you're in New York, and we should point out your godmother is Vivian Leigh. Your
yes.
godfather is Noel Coward. Not bad, Juliet. and Vivian is doing a play at the same time you are and invites you to a screening. Can you tell us about that screening?
Yes. She was doing a play called Duel of Angels, and I was doing Five Finger Exercise. And she called me up one day and she said, "You know, they're screening Gone with the Wind at the Ziegfeld Theatre in Times Square, and they've asked me to attend." And she said, "I haven't seen it since originally when it came out, and she said, I'd quite like to see it. Would you like to come with me?" So I had the great honor and pleasure of sitting next to her, watching her in Gone with the Wind. Yeah,
and
unforgettable.
We both know about those eyes that she had that were so beautiful.
Beautiful.
And that luminous face. I mean, it was really something. And it's interesting that you mentioned the Ziegfeld. I was in charge of the Ziegfeld Theater. And not only was that where you saw Gone with the Wind, but I launched in America Ryan's Daughter, where your dad won the Academy Award.
That's right. Yes.
So that's, yeah. I guess, our connection.
That's wonderful. I like that, Julian. Yeah. Well,
and Juliet, you were at the Academy Awards with your dad when he won.
Yes.
Now, I am going to ask you a question I'll guarantee you no one's ever asked. You ready?
Yeah.
Why was your dad arm in a sling?
I bet nobody has asked me, actually.
No.
I'll tell you why. Because a couple of months before, he was at a restaurant in London called the White Elephant, and he and my mother were leaving after dinner, and the doorman hailed a black cab, and as he got into the cab, he had his hand in the door, the hinge, and the doorman slammed the door and took the tip of his little finger off.
Oh, my.
And Mummy retrieved the tip. They rushed off to hospital. He had this, they couldn't regraft it. It was too mushed up. But a little while later, he did have skin grafted onto that little finger that had been nipped. And he was most upset about it because it meant he couldn't play the ukulele, which he loved to do. Anyway, he did in the end. But so that was why he just had that surgery on his little finger, and he had his arm in a sling. And
that's true. Now, in Five Finger Exercise, you decided at the age of 16, probably 17 at that point, you have an autograph book, which
yes.
I'm told you still have.
I do.
And
yes.
Let's talk about some of the people who signed that autograph book, and if there's any stories with them coming backstage. Let's start out with the Streetcar Named Desire on the waterfront, Marlon Brando.
Yeah, well, Marlon Brando, he didn't come backstage. I got his autograph later. In London, I was at an event with my father, and I don't know, I think Mummy wasn't well, so he took me to some very grand event. Prince Charles was there, very young, and so was Marlon Brando, and so was Princess Alexandra, actually. And I asked Marlon for his autograph at that event, and we didn't have anything to write on, and so he wrote it on a napkin, on the corner of his napkin. And so that is in my book. I pasted it into my autograph book. But I started that book as you said, when I was doing Five Fingers, because all these amazing people would come round and I'd be so thrilled to meet them that I'd think, I've got to get their signatures, you know. And I was oriented in that way because of Daddy and everybody wanting his autograph, you know. I understood the value of an autograph, you know. So
I just want you to know, Juliet, that if things ever get tough for you and Maxwell, that book is worth a lot of money.
I bet it is. Actually, I got Montgomery Clift.
Henry Fonda,
Montgomery Clift, Frederick March, Helen Hayes, Anne Bancroft, Tyrone Power, Douglas Fairbanks. I mean, Billy Wilder. Billy Wilder came to see it.
Well, and later you end up working with Billy Wilder.
He said to me, one day we'll work together. And about 25 years later, he made that come true for me.
He kept his promise, a little bit tardy, but he kept his promise.
He did.
Well, we can jump to Avante. We'll go back and forth. But on Avante, Neil Simon, who I knew, would work. You couldn't change a word of Neil Simon's plays. On the other hand, I worked with Woody Allen. He didn't care as long as you told the joke. You couldn't change the joke. But Billy Wilder was pretty tough on words, wasn't he?
Absolutely. You didn't change a word. You didn't change a punctuation with Billy. What was written was, that was it. You didn't mess around, no. He was very strict about that, and rightfully so. I mean, you know, he and I.L. Diamond, who co-wrote a lot. They wrote Avante together. It's so finely tuned and so brilliant, the dialogue and everything. You can't interfere with the rhythm, you know, of great comedy writing. So you can't add buts and o's and no's and punctuation.
Well, it's interesting too, because that movie, as you know, initially was not successful, did not get particularly good reviews, but it's become a cult classic film with you and Jack Lemmon as the two stars. Not bad, Juliet. Billy Wilder and Jack Lemmon doing pretty good. No longer an autograph book. They're in person this time. tell me a little bit about having to gain weight. A, why in that film did you have to? And B, was it very difficult, even though you're on the Amalfi Coast, which has some pretty good restaurants?
Yes, but I had to gain the weight before I got there. Oh. It was pretty easy to keep it on once I got, you know, but I don't know. My father always, he was always... He didn't like the fact that I had to put on that weight. He said, it's just for one lousy joke, fat ass, he said. because actually, I just finished doing Nanny when I met with Billy, and he said he wanted me to play this part. And he wanted this girl that this American executive fell in love with not to be the, you know, the obvious sort of bimbette on the Riviera in the bikini and the whole thing. You know, he wanted a very offbeat relationship, an unlikely, incongruous pair. And so he said, I want you to put on 35 pounds. Can you do it? And he said, you've got 3 months. I said, yes, I can, and I will, and, you know. And I, of course, because it was Billy Wilder, I would have put on 50 pounds to work with him.
Well, or lost 20 if you had to.
But it was it was hard. It was difficult, I mean, to put on that much. Because I was naturally slim and kind of healthy, you know, and I had to start really stuffing myself, eating huge breakfasts and porridge and bacon and eggs, and then lunch and then dinner and then ice cream last thing at night. And I got to, on my way to Rome, I flew from Los Angeles on my way to start filming in Rome, and I stopped off in England to see my parents, and I was going to stay there a week, and I was still like 7 pounds under the requested weight increase. And I said, I'm 7 pounds under. What am I going to do? I can't. I eat all the time. I can't. I feel full all the time. So he says, don't worry. He said, Carlsberg special brew. That's it. We'll
help.
Both drink Carlsberg special brew all day. So we were both pissed for about a week.
Much of the time. Were you able to lose the weight at the end of the shoot pretty easily?
Yes, actually, I was so happy to stop eating by that time. Because when we were actually filming and we shot for 8 weeks, you know, I was there in Rome on my own, and Billy and Audrey, his wife, and Jack and Felicia were there. So they always invited me to dinner. It wasn't just working with him. I actually spent that 2 months with them and with Billy and Audrey all the time. And he wanted me to keep eating. He made sure I went out to dinner to eat, you know, fed me all the time, feeding me. So when the film was over, I just stopped eating for about, I think I did a 7-day fast of, you know, juice and water and juice and tea and whatever, herb tea and all that. And I felt much better for it. And then I did the grapefruit diet for a while, which is a great diet. And you really do lose 10 pounds. When I did the fast, that started me on not eating much, so much. You know, I had to shrink my stomach again, you know.
When you look back on your career, do you think as a younger woman you were very ambitious or not?
No, I don't think I was really. And that's a strange thing, and I still am not. I've never really been that ambitious. I've been very lucky, and work's always come to me. Not so much now, I have to say, but I don't mind that. Because of the age I am and all the other things I like to do, as well as work. But I just, I've forgotten what I was going to say now.
About ambition.
Yeah, no, not really very ambitious. Very lucky. But I never was thinking, I want to do this part and I want to do that part and I want to be a film star. I want to be famous. No, I didn't have that kind of drive at all. No.
You know, when I study your life and your career, it's amazing to me what you touched on a minute earlier, how many things came to you. Now, it's an amazing, you're doing Alfie on Broadway. And you never know who's going to be in the audience. To tell you a quick story, Carol Haney was a wonderful actress and singer, and she was in The Pajama Game. The night that she got sick, she couldn't go on. The understudy named Shirley MacLaine came on, and the producer, director Hal Wallace, was in the audience. And that's how Shirley's career happened. So now we're going to have you and Alfie. We've got Victor McLaughlin's son, it looks like. Andrew McLaughlin's going to come in, and he sees you and wants you for this movie. It's amazing. You didn't even have to do an audition, I don't think.
No, I didn't. Do a screen test for Rare Breed. You're talking about, Rare Breed with Jimmy Stewart. I mean, no, that's luck, you know. Very, very, very good luck. And I loved doing Alfie with Terry Stamp in New York. That was a dream come true as well. I did audition for that, and unfortunately, the play wasn't a big hit on Broadway like it was in London. I think partly because in those days they couldn't understand the Cockney. It was very broad, and you know. now all the accents and Scottish or anything, even broad accents, are understood in America. But in way back then, you know, those British films didn't come over here. They didn't get distribution in the same way they do now. So
that's
people,
right,
their ears weren't attuned, and Terry was very broad Cockney in that. It was practically Cockney slang, you know. And so the Broadway audience didn't understand him.
No, and they got a real Cockney to play the movie in Michael Caine.
Yes, right.
Okay, rare breed. Also, your mother is a woman named Maureen O'Hara. We're not kidding around here, Juliet. You're really working with the top people. I'm told, now this may not be true, but I'm told that the first day that you're there, Jimmy Stewart sent 36 roses, 3 bouquets. Is that true?
One bouquet of 36 roses, 3 dozen red roses in my dressing room. Yeah.
Oh, my golly. Well, that... Tell us, is there any interesting stories that you could relate about working with Maureen and Jimmy Stewart? And, oh, speaking of accents, I think Brian Keith was doing Scottish accent at that point.
He was. He was crazy. He was very funny in that, I must say. Rather over the top, a little over the top, but funny. Yeah. He enjoyed himself in that film, I can tell you, hamming it up as he was.
But working with...
It was a wonderful experience doing a Western in the first place, you know, and, oh, Daddy was so, he was so jealous. He said, I've always wanted to do a Western, and now you're doing one with Jimmy Stewart, a cowboy, a real cowboy. We went on location, outside of Palm Springs to do all the location, you know, because they actually built the little town in a studio in Universal. I mean, it was a brilliant set, really. But we did a lot of stuff outside, and they were sweet to me, and he was just the way you'd expect him to be. You know, those great actors like Jimmy and Jack Lemmon, they're just as you see them on the screen. That's them. They are. They're, you know, except when they're playing heavies or something, but they're generous. They're wonderful actors. It's like when you play tennis with somebody who's better than you. You play better because they're better. Oh. You know, it's just wonderful working with those people. And Jimmy had a lot of... He loved filming. He loved filming Westerns. He loved playing cowboys. He loved riding. He had his own horse on the set, the horse that he always rode on all his Westerns, you know. And he adopted Vindicator, the bull, after we'd finished shooting to make sure he wasn't turned into steak, you know.
Yes.
And he sent him to his ranch in Montana. He had a ranch in Montana. And I remember the first week of shooting at some point, maybe it was the end of the week, all the crew and Jimmy were going to a bar, and he invited me to go along, and he really enjoyed ordering me a yard of beer. Now, I didn't even know what a yard of beer was. I'd never even heard of a yard of beer. A pint of beer, yes, but anyway, you probably know what a yard of beer is. It's a big glass like that, very tall glass with a ball on the end. A bowl, so you can't put it down. It would fall over, so you have to drink it. Oh,
that was quite an initiation, I would say. Did you rehearse with Maureen? Because you're playing her daughter, if I remember correctly. Did you have scenes where you rehearsed before you shot?
We did, but not sort of as much, not very much. We didn't have any rehearsal period, just rehearsed before, you know, we actually shot the scenes, blocked it, rehearsed it, shot it, you know, and didn't do sort of previous rehearsals. Like with Avanti, we were in Italy, in Sorrento, actually, and we had like a whole week where we just rehearsed, you know, before we started shooting. I knew Maureen because I had done a live TV with her. When I was doing Five Finger Exercise, I was asked to do Mrs. Miniver. She was doing a TV version of Mrs. Miniver, and I played her daughter. Oh. And so that was, so I'd actually met her when I was like 17 or something. So
yes, so it wasn't new. You were playing her daughter again?
Yes, yeah.
Well, I want you to know, I bet you don't know this, and I think you'll like to hear it, but I was looking up the reviews of Rare Breed, and one of the major critics said, Juliet Mills steals the first part of this movie. Now, this is not bad, Juliet, against Jimmy Stewart and Maureen O'Hara. You got wonderful reviews for that movie. You really did. I don't even know if you're aware of that.
No, actually, I'm not. But I'm glad to hear you say that because we saw it recently on the big screen. They screened it here at the Ojai Film Festival.
Oh, yes.
Last year in the summer. And I hadn't seen it since we shot it, you know, and Maxwell had never seen it on the big screen. And he, at the end of it, he said that same thing. He said, "You steal that movie."
Well, I want to get to I'm happy to say that Tom Courtney is a dear friend. I brought him over from England on a play called Moscow Stations that I produced with him. I thought he was wonderful. I know you worked with him in She Stoops to Conquer. And of course, this is the segue into one of your biggest successes. But let's start with She Stoops to Conquer. You're doing that show and someone gets to you and says,
yeah, well, the producer of was doing a TV series, planning to do one, and he came to see She Stoops to Conquer and asked me to do a screen test for this character of Nanny in a show he was producing called Nanny and the Professor. And so I did a screen test in London and I got the part, and then they actually let me out of the play for 3 weeks to go and shoot the pilot. And I went back into the play and finished the run with dear Tom, who I adore to this day. And we've stayed in touch very much as possible since I live here in America.
So, okay, you try out for this show. You do the pilot. Do you have any feeling about whether it's going to make it or not? Are you?
Not at all. I just thought to myself, you know, I just thought, well, I didn't really think about it much at all. And when I heard I'd got it, I thought it would just be sort of 13 episodes or something. I didn't think of it as a long-term, you know, a series exactly. I didn't know.
And to make you for a while one of the most popular actors in the world, because this show was not just in America. It played all over the world.
It did. Yeah. Nanny and the Professor was a very, very a big success, as you say, internationally. And it was a lovely show, lovely family show, fun show. It was a great part for me. I believed in all the things that Nanny believed in, magic and ESP and, you know, talking to the animals, and Richard Long and I were very good friends, and his family kind of embraced me coming over and being on my own. And his wife, Mara Corday, who was a beautiful, beautiful actress herself, although she wasn't acting anymore. But I spent a lot of time with the family, and it was a very, very happy experience. And of course, it went on. Well, we did, I think, 64 shows altogether. We had 3 seasons of it.
Yeah. It's also, you know, in our business, we talk often about if the actors have chemistry. Well, you and Richard Long, right from the pilot, I watched the pilot today, right from the pilot. Just amazing how that can happen. And also, we've been involved, both of us, where it doesn't happen, but we won't discuss that particularly. Oh, yeah. Maybe we will. Maybe we will. I'll give you one example. Don Adams, Get Smart. What the hell? After all, you've been around a while, as I have. What do you think his problem was? What was that about, do you think?
I don't know. I don't know. I think he's just an angry little man. You know what I mean? He wasn't a very nice man, really.
No. Well, you know, it is funny, but often people who are comics are not particularly the nicest people in the world. Not everyone. But think Julietta Vernacular. I killed them last night. I slaughtered them last night. I murdered them last night. I mean, this is a tad aggressive, to say the least, you know.
I don't know.
But anyhow, back to the good chemistry of you and Richard Long. Did you get involved to the point, because, by the way, you and your dad in the business are known as two of the nicest people to work with. I've never, ever, and I mean this, heard a negative thing. I would love when your dad was older and they'd say, oh, Johnny this and Johnny that. I thought, Sir John Mills, you're calling him Johnny. But there it was. But I wanted to just to know, did you get involved enough to say, oh, I don't think the nanny would do that, or I don't think the nanny would say that? Did you get that involved with the show? I know
I would have if I didn't agree, because I really took over the character. You know, she was me, I was her. But it was beautifully written. A.J. Carruthers, who created the character, the story, wrote a lot of the scripts. I did get involved to the extent that I wrote one script myself.
You did.
But I never disagreed with anything that came along. And, you know, we had wonderful guest cast. It was always somebody fascinating.
Including your father.
Including my father. They wrote a script especially for Brian Bedford, my friend. Actually, yes. We got married, him and me, or maybe it was a fantasy wedding or something. I can't remember. But anyway, you know, they were wonderful.
I don't think the nanny ever married. And I think that may have been one of the reasons they made a mistake, in my opinion.
Yes. Me too, I must say, because especially during the second season, people would ask and say, what's going on? Why don't you two? Doesn't he fancy? I mean, you two are so great together. And it would have taken it to another level, you know, story-wise.
I'm sure they thought of it. I wonder why they rejected it. Do you have any idea?
I don't. It was just very prudish in those days. You know, we're talking many, many years ago. I wasn't able to be seen in my bedroom in a nightgown unless I had. It was had to be long flannel nightgown, long sleeves up to the neck.
Yes.
You know, and I couldn't offer him a scotch and soda when he came home or a drink.
No.
I'd have to offer him a cup of tea. I mean, those were the directives sent down from, you know, necessarily the studio, but the network.
The network made a gigantic mistake in retrospect. Why they took that out of the Friday night slot, why they moved it. Not only did they move Nanny and the Professor from a great spot where it had done beautifully, they put it against Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In and Gunsmoke. I mean, are you kidding? Two of the most established shows. And it just made no sense. But
no,
that's what they call a Monday morning quarterbacking. You can't go backwards. That's over. We can't. But I am interested in knowing, because we haven't gotten to Passions, a daytime series that I don't think, with the exception maybe of Dark Shadows, anyone had ever seen. This kind of supernatural, very interesting. And you're Tabitha the witch. The good witch, the bad witch, you start out bad, you turn out good. Was this fun for you, this particular?
Great fun. Yeah, that was another very lucky strike for me. I'd never done a soap. I would never do another one either, I can tell you. It's incredibly hard work, all-consuming, especially as I was always, you know, I had these long monologues because I was always talking to inanimate objects or animals or a doll. So I had a lot of dialogue, and I had to work very, very hard. I enjoyed it very much, but it was, you know, 9 years of really solid graft.
And the truth is, on those daytime soap operas, even those that are not about the supernatural, it's an enormous, they change and you have to keep doing it. The memorization is really something. I've had friends on those shows who said, I liked it. I'll never do it again. And you just echoed that thought. So
yes, yeah, really. I'm glad I did it, and it was wonderful financially to have a regular job.
Yes,
and it was a wonderful group of people, and I still have friends from that experience. You know, it was a real family, and NBC spent a fortune on that show to start off with. I mean, the productions were huge. It was very innovative as far as a soap goes.
Oh, yes.
And we all had a lot of fun on it. It was terrific.
Let's talk about QB7. This is an incredible maxi series, a lot of 6.5 hours. And you win the Emmy for this. And you're working with some of the great actors in the business. Tell us, how did that come to pass? Do you remember how you got the job?
Yes, that really came to pass through Doug Kramer, who produced it. And he worked with Aaron Spelling. And I'd done some work for them. You know, they did all the Love Boats and Hotels and Fantasy Island and all that. And Doug was a big fan of mine and a great friend, and he wanted me for that part. And it was right after I'd done Avanti that I shot that, actually. So, that was just offered to me because of Doug. And it was a wonderful experience and fun. I worked mostly with Ben Gazzara and Lee Remick, but it was great. It was an interesting a challenge for me because I went through different ages. You know, I started as a young nurse and ended up as a alcoholic wife.
tell me a little bit, if you would, about winning the Emmy itself. Did you think you had? I know your father said he didn't think he had a chance in the world. Did you think you had any chance at all?
No, I didn't. I'd never won a prize, and I didn't think, I knew there were a lot of very good actors nominated with me, including Lee Remick, I think.
Yes, probably.
Yeah. Anyway, no, I was aghast and astonished and very proud and thrilled. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I'm interested in knowing about how important, because you said earlier about the belief of paranormal and many things like that. As a child, did you have any mystical or magic experiences? Sounds like your whole career. If we say Nanny, there's an example. If we say the Passions, there's an example. I mean, you're often working in a field and that you kind of enjoy the mystical, etc. Anything happen as a child that you remember?
I mean, not really. I mean, like, I've never seen a ghost. I've always wanted to, and I've lived in ancient houses where maybe they are.
Yes.
Where one would see one. But Mummy was always into all that. And we used to do the Ouija board, you know, the thing, that seance thing. And
that can be very...
When we were children with Mummy and Daddy, and that was always fascinating.
It is, but it also can be very dangerous.
Yes,
I've known examples where not such a great thing to be doing.
No, I have too. And troublesome spirits making trouble. I know.
You don't know, mummy was Irish. I say you don't realize it, but often you're bringing them in, giving them a place to go. Yeah.
Yes, I know. I don't do it anymore.
No, I'm glad. I'm glad to hear that. Anyhow,
mummy was into all of spiritual, you know, she was very psychic in her own way. So we always believed in magic and fairies and, you know, but I can't say I've had an experience of the one thing that Maxwell doesn't like me telling this story because we were coming home very late from an event in Los Angeles, driving up to where we live, which is 80 miles north. We were both tired, and he said to me, "Oh, just lie back, close your eyes, and, you know, go to sleep if you want. I'm fine." And I never do that in the car. I always stay up and awake. But I did sort of lie back and sort of doze off. And I suddenly felt a hand on my shoulder, pushing very hard on my shoulder to wake me up. And I woke up and I looked over at Maxwell, and his head was going down over the steering wheel like he was just about to fall asleep. So that's my only personal experience of one of my guardian angels. A tangible thing, but I feel them around all the time anyway.
Well, I can assure you, so does my wife. And one day I know the two of you I hope get together and have a good time on that. Now, she's written a new book that will be coming out. It's called The Clairvoyant's Daughter, Growing Up in a Mystical World. And in that book, she tells stories that you would love to read. So I have to make a note to make sure when that book comes out that I send it to you and Maxwell.
Oh, so please do. I would love to read it. I'm very interested. Yeah.
Yeah. And anyhow, thank you, Juliet. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us on Julian Schlossberg's Movie Talk. Remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.